This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got Arsalan Iftikhar, the National Legal Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Without warrant or reason, the government's monitoring Muslim homes, businesses, and mosques, checking for radiation. Congress wants to investigate President Bush's actions authorizing the NSA to spy on us Americans and people living in America. We'll talk with Lisa Graves of the ACLU about that. Human Rights Watch researcher John Sifton will join us to tell us about his crucial role in unveiling the black CIA torture sites all over Europe.
Where in the world is the CIA keeping and torturing people?
Attorney Sabin Willett defending all the Uyghur Muslims at Guantanamo Bay.
This is their fifth year of detention. Completely innocent. People without a country. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. We didn't even know what the word rendition meant.
Yeah. Extraordinary rendition.
I mean, I always thought rendition meant was you melted down a steer to get the fat, which I think it does mean. It's a packing house term. All the things you look back the last couple of years of what's happened, the camp they set up in Guantanamo,
yeah.
The Abu Ghraib stuff, the secret prisons they had in Poland and Romania that they now have moved to somewhere in North Africa. The whole gulag that we know exists, the number of private aircraft corporations that work for the CIA and that fly people to all these prisons that exist all over the place.
Well, you know what makes me so angry? Even after all of that, after all the shame that's been brought out upon the U.S. government as a result of revealing all of their lawless behavior, after all that, the U.S. government has the nerve to say that in Iraq, they do not want to hand over Iraqi jails and Iraqi detainees over to Iraqis because they're worried about mistreatment. I mean, not to say that the Iraqis have their hands clean in the jails that they've been running, but you've got to be kidding me. The American government is running the most lawless prisons there are in the world today. I mean, these black sites, the Guantanamo prisons, and spitting in the face of international law and the international community to do all of this. And then they have the nerve to say, we don't trust anybody else to handle prisons. They couldn't do it any worse than the Americans.
And people abroad, if you've traveled recently, have lost all respect for what they thought, however mistakenly, was great American democracy. I don't think it anymore. Our next guest is John Sifton from Human Rights Watch. He is the terrorism and counterterrorism researcher, and he's done some work recently that has gained tremendous prominence, which has to do with the renditions, the sending of people by the CIA to other countries where they can be held or tortured, and also exposed CIA so-called black sites, some of which may have been or may still be in Western Europe and other parts of the world where the CIA keeps people in detention and or interrogates them in a fashion that is contrary to the Convention Against Torture. John, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, why don't you describe a little bit about the report that you made a few weeks ago that really has blown this whole thing open?
Well, we've been looking for a while for the site at which the CIA holds a lot of the so-called ghost prisoners. These are prisoners who aren't held with access to lawyers or to the Red Cross. Most of them are suspected terrorists, people who were picked up in other countries and then put into CIA custody. Some of them may be innocent people who've been picked up by mistake. We don't know, but we don't really have any way of determining anything about them because we don't know where they are. We did a lot of research trying to find out where they might be held, and some suggestions pointed to Eastern Europe, to Poland and Romania. We were working on this story through the summer. It looks as though some journalists, parallel to our efforts, came up with some information finding it in Eastern Europe as well, and that's when the Dana Priest story came out. We put out our information. Some other journalists have found out other information, and right now the ball really lies with the Council of Europe, which is the main human rights body in Europe, and they've got to finish their investigation, and hopefully they'll find out the precise places in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Romania, that were used.
Now, that's a man named Dick Marty, I know, is working for the Council of Europe and issued at least some preliminary discussion or report on this. Is that right?
That's correct, but more investigation is really needed. We need to find out exactly where the sites were in Poland and Romania and how long people were held there and what the countries knew. Now, both governments, Poland and Romania, have new governments now, new presidents, new governments. So it's not as though it's easy to find out what the old government did, but we're hoping that Dick Marty and the European Union and the Council of Europe can get to the bottom of this.
There are two ways that the CIA renders people, as far as I understand. One is that the CIA will kidnap people and render them to facilities that are in other countries that are U.S. run, and they are, you know, interrogated and or tortured by U.S. personnel. The other way is that the U.S. sends them to countries where you have interrogators and prisons that are run by that country itself. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, there's a wide variety of ways in which people are picked up. People have been picked up in Afghanistan. They've been arrested in Karachi, Pakistan, and Thailand. They've been picked up in places in Europe. And it looks like the CIA is basically the air transport service, and either they're transporting it into their own prisons or to other countries to hold and interrogate.
How did this come about?
Well, a lot of this started in the 1990s. President Clinton authorized some renditions of suspects who were picked up in the Caucasus, were sent back to Egypt. But it really didn't, you know, pick up as a big, big thing until after September 11th.
Now, let me ask you, what I always understood was that Clinton's renditions were generally picking up people for trial when they'd been indicted or were going to be indicted in another country, so they weren't really sort of ghost detainees. Am I right about that?
Yeah, but, I mean, that's what's happened in this program as well. A lot of people actually have been tried. It's just that we don't particularly believe in the judicial systems of Uzbekistan or Egypt, for instance.
Oh, so you mean they've been taken to these countries and tried in those countries?
Yeah, a lot of these people haven't been held as ghosts in those countries. There's several people who were rendered by the CIA to Egypt and to Uzbekistan and to Morocco, for that matter, who have been tried and sentenced. It's just that we fear that they may have been tortured before trial into signing false confessions or that other abuses may be occurring even now. So whether there was a trial or not is kind of an irrelevant issue to the purpose of determining whether the person is likely to be tortured.
About how many people do you estimate have been picked up since 9/11?
You know, I don't even try to estimate anymore. I think that a lot of people have been moved around who are pretty low level, probably in the high hundreds.
Dana Priest has a number of 3,000 from that counterterrorism, whatever it is, unit at the bottom of the CIA. But
yeah, I mean, government admissions, you know, is one thing. But as far as estimating the numbers, it's very difficult because of the high level of secrecy surrounding most of these transfers. And a lot of them are low level. You know, they pick up a couple kids in Pakistan who are at a madras, who may or may not have a connection with some operation somewhere else, and they interrogate them. They find out that, you know, there's no information they have, and so they ship them back to their country, Malaysia, for instance, or Indonesia. And who knows what the Malaysians do with them.
Let me ask another question here, because you've talked about the people who get sent to the, either the black sites or to other countries, and named possibly Poland and Romania. But a lot of the European countries apparently have now started to look at their own role, if any, in these scores, if not hundreds of flights in some cases that may have been CIA transportation flights.
Yeah.
Is there anything? What's going on with that story?
Well, I don't think it's the big part of the story. I think it's more a sort of journalistic phenomenon where everybody wants a bit of the action. So, for instance, Ireland and Canada are sort of bending over backwards trying to find some connection to the scandal. You know, the big story is, where are the prisons now, and where were they in Eastern Europe? You know, if a plane landed in Shannon Airport in Ireland and refueled, you know, should Irish people be upset about that? Yes, and they should lobby their government. But I don't think it should be a sort of major scandal that it's been made into. Because the key issue that we have to get to is, where is the U.S. holding prisoners now? What are they doing to them? Let's, you know, nail those countries. And there's another phenomenon here which has been very problematic. It's not getting much attention, which is that Western European politicians are using this information about Poland and Romania for their own anti-Eastern European reasons. And it's just, they're more interested in beating up on Poland and Romania, trying to keep Romania out of the EU and beating up on Poland for supporting Bush, than they are in really getting to the bottom of this story. So there's a lot of disingenuous activity going on here.
Now, as part of this story, you also issued a list of 26 people. Can you tell us about that list?
There are likely several score disappeared people at the highest levels in these ghost prisons, but we've only been able to actually figure out about 26 at this point who we can name. There are a handful more that we're still trying to confirm are in custody, in the U.S. custody. These are people, most of whom are suspected of involvement in terrorist attacks September 11th, the Cole bombing, the Bali bombings, the embassy bombings in Africa. Some have even been indicted under federal law. So we're not saying, you know, these are necessarily great people. What we're saying is the U.S. is blowing whatever whatever chance it has to ever charge these guys for the crimes they're alleged to have committed.
And beyond that, it's illegal.
Of course it's illegal. But, I mean, I don't want to make these guys into some heroes, because then everybody beats up on us and the Wall Street Journal says we're trying to free terrorists. We're not. I mean, if these people are bad people, fine. They should be prosecuted. And you're blowing whatever chance you have of prosecuting them by holding them illegally and subjecting them to torture, because whatever confessions they give, whatever evidence they give, is going to be inadmissible. Blow the opportunity to prosecute.
You know, I recently read something in the paper that the Congress was insisting on getting reports about these prisons, about the number of them, where they were, what happens to people, whether they're being treated humanely. And I'm not sure I had the right reaction, but my reaction was, it was almost a way of saying it's legal to, they weren't saying it was legal to do this, but there was a way of, which sure it's a step forward in some way for Congress, but in another way, it's almost like they're accepting the practice rather than saying this is an illegal practice. I just, interested in your thoughts about it.
This is the phenomenon that I really don't like, is this sort of well-meaning neoliberal approach. Sort of Phil Hyman up in Harvard and Juliet Kayyem have done this thing where it's like, oh, if we have congressional oversight, somehow things will be better. I couldn't disagree more. Congressional oversight is not the answer. These are illegal activities. The CIA operatives who are involved in them are breaking federal criminal law. The answer is to stop the activities and investigate whether people are criminally liable for what they've done. The answer isn't to have more hearings. I mean, what they're proposing, this reporting requirement, right now, four people in Congress hear about these ghost sites, probably the chiefs of the intelligence committees in the Senate. So it'll be expanded to what? 18 people in the Senate are going to hear about it? That's not transparency. That's just a slight larger level of reporting requirements for the Senate. It's not going to end these illegal activities.
And that was my take as well. And my last question really is about something I read, that the sites in Romania and Poland may have been moved and maybe to somewhere in North Africa. Have any comment about that?
Well, I can't talk about our ongoing research, but we're definitely trying to figure out where people are being held. I don't think it's all in one place. I think a lot of these people have been moved around to separate places.
John Sifton, Human Rights Watch. He's a counterterrorism and terrorism researcher there and has been one of the key people in exposing the CIA practice of picking people up and moving them around the world into various prisons as well as sending them to various countries. John, thanks a lot for being on Law and Disorder with us.
Thanks.
Recently, Americans discovered that President Bush has authorized the National Security Agency to spy on Americans.
And what they've done is they've gone behind the back of everybody to the major telephone companies and cut deals to get access to the telephone companies' arteries. This is their satellite dishes. It's their undersea cables. It's their phone cables. Instead of going to a court or to the special FISA court, they've behind our backs gone to the big corporations and they're spying on us. When we make a phone call to another American here or somebody abroad or we send an email, all this stuff is being picked up by them with absolutely no court sanction.
With us, we have Lisa Graves, a senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. Lisa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Lisa, what's going on now?
Well, in the wake of the revelations that the Bush administration has violated our federal laws to authorize wiretapping without a court order, there have been a number of statements from members of Congress calling for investigations and suggesting quite correctly that this is illegal and improper.
Why is it illegal?
Well, in 1978, Congress passed a law in the wake of revelations of widespread spying by President Nixon on people in the United States in the name of national security. Congress passed a law back then to say that any foreign intelligence wiretaps have to have the approval of a court. It created a special court, and that law has been unquestioned and followed for the past quarter century until President Bush took over.
And then what happened?
Well, a lot of things happened. I think that one of the main things that happened is that the president has surrounded himself with extremists who believe that the president has no limits on his power, not just in the area of wiretaps, but also in the area of torture. Basically, the president's advisors have advised that the president can change or rewrite any federal law or our treaties at will, that the president can dictate the law, and that he has basically unchecked or unmitigated or unimpaired powers, as the Vice President Cheney said.
Yeah, well, that's that would be our definition, I think, of a police state, wouldn't it? Wasn't one of the allegations in the articles of impeachment against Nixon that he was doing that very same thing?
Well, that's my understanding. And in fact, the Supreme Court rebuked the administration, the Nixon administration. It said in a case involving whether the president could engage in wiretap during the Vietnam War in the name of national security, the Supreme Court unanimously said that our Fourth Amendment is meaningless unless the president has some check on his power to conduct wiretaps in this country.
Yeah, how far does this political spying go?
Well, it's unclear. The president suggests that he's only focusing on agents of al-Qaeda or people in contact with al-Qaeda, and
please,
the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is quite clear that if you have someone who is an agent of al-Qaeda or conspiring or assisting in an al-Qaeda operative, a terrorist, that you can get a wiretap with a court order. What the law does not allow is for every American in this country to be treated as a suspect without any evidence of wrongdoing on their part. And the law simply does not allow the president, any president of any party, to wiretap the telephone conversations or internet communications of ordinary Americans without a warrant.
You know what I suspect? Because it wasn't like the FISA court was presented such great burdens to the government when they came to it and asked for a warrant. I think there were over 10,000 applications and only four were turned down. Isn't that true?
I can certainly count on the fingers of my hands.
Why wouldn't they want to go to FISA then if it was an automatic? And what I suspect is that they were doing something that would offend even these rubber-stamped FISA court judges. Well, what could that be? Maybe you could assume they were spying on other attorneys.
Well, you know, it's hard to know because unless there is a judicial check, there's no way to know who they're spying on, and there's no way to know that they're only spying on people who have some connection as agents of Al-Qaeda. The fact of the matter is that when the National Security Agency turns its array of electronic eavesdropping tools inward on the United States on innocent, lawful conduct, lawful telephone calls, lawful internet use by Americans, that all of our liberties are at risk. And the notion that the government can simply prowl through the communications of anyone in the United States at will is unacceptable in a constitutional democracy.
Well, Lisa, tell us, what's wrong? I mean, we hear a lot of times people saying, well, you know, if people aren't doing anything illegal, what's the problem here?
Well, the heart of privacy, the heart of our liberty, is the notion that the government cannot take our things, cannot seize our property, including our communications, without a warrant. We cannot allow this administration to give the terrorists their first victory in this war by making our Constitution the casualty in this effort.
And didn't Bush state publicly that, yes, I'm doing this and I've got a right to do it?
He has been arrogant, to say the least. I think that it's actually a sign of weakness. They probably fear greatly that there are consequences for this illegal behavior, and so they feel that they must posture strongly in order to try to deflect any criticism of it. But it's quite clear that people inside the administration were so troubled by this that they have basically blown the whistle on it. And the fact of the matter is that the National Security Agency and the ACLU has obtained documents from the NSA in previous litigation. The fact of the matter is that the NSA has a prime directive that has been violated by this administration. That directive for the past nearly three decades has been that the NSA cannot spy on U.S. citizens, on people in this country, whether their calls are domestic or international, without a court order.
What do you think the fallout's going to be, both for the administration and for these telecommunications companies that gave up the information?
Well, I think it's a blow to the rule of law in this country if we are forced to be in a situation where our rights are at the whim of the president, any president. And so I hope that there will be a really probing investigation, many hearings in Congress examining this issue. And I hope, and I certainly think it's warranted, for there to be an appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate which criminal laws were broken, how many times they were broken, and by whom, and to hold every single one of those people accountable, because no person is above the law. In terms of the telephone companies that have allowed the NSA to tap into the main artery of our communication system and monitor communications here in this country, I hope that they'll be hearing from consumers who say, when I sign up for the telephone or the internet, I am not signing up or approving or giving permission for the government to wiretap me or my communications, my intimate communications, or my business communications. That's loud and clear.
We're talking with Lisa Graves from the ACLU. We're here on Law and Disorder. Lisa, isn't Congressman John Conyers looking into this with the view of developing information that might lead to an impeachment of Bush for doing this and standing up and admitting that he did it and continuing to do it?
Well, that's my understanding, is that there are members of Congress who believe this to be a high crime and misdemeanor under the terms of the Constitution. In fact, even John Dean, the former White House counsel for President Nixon, who had engaged in warrantless wiretapping before he was rebuked by the Supreme Court, has said that this is an impeachable offense. I'm not going to say that here. I think that I would leave that to Congress. That power rests in the House of Representatives to bring such a bill, and such a trial would take place in the United States Senate.
If telephone companies, if Verizon's found to have given up information and communications that they should never, AOL, how can they be held liable?
Well, it's hard to say, in part because individuals don't know that their communications have been turned over, and so it's hard for them individually to sue. But I would hope that all of those telecom communications would be hearing from customers demanding that they be told if their conversations have been tapped, and that they be told clearly that they have not authorized any such warrantless wiretaps of their conversations. I'm sure that there are people who will be pursuing litigation to vindicate people's rights.
You know, Lisa, I understand that the NSA has two huge data mining centers, one outside of Washington, D.C., and another one on the West Coast, I think in the state of Washington. And they tap into satellites under the ocean cables, and they also tap into phone lines, and that they're like a huge vacuum cleaner that can monitor all sorts of domestic and international communication. So I would guess that that most Americans have a beef here.
Well, I believe so. I think that the revelations that the administration has co-opted the telephone companies, the telecom companies, to conduct these warrantless taps of people's conversations, of their phone calls or their emails, that basically gives us 280 million reasons to be concerned, because the rights of every American are at risk if any president, no matter what party, has the power unilaterally to intercept and keep their most intimate conversations.
Really, I'd like to see not only the governmental people responsible for this being brought to justice, but the corporate people as well.
Well, I think that we have an unfortunate circumstance here where basically the administration has sought to deputize other people in its own lawless activities. So we indeed are facing a constitutional crisis, a legal crisis, and a crisis that I would never have imagined would take place in this country in terms of whether we're going to be a nation governed by the rule of law or not.
I just can't believe how things have degenerated since 9/11. What scares me is that if there's another horrible event like 9/11 and people are scared more than they are now, you can imagine what the Bush people would like to do.
Well, that's true. I mean, they have certainly indicated they believe that there are no bounds to the president's power in this country in terms of the ability to rewrite or disregard our laws, laws that the president is charged with faithfully executing. I do think that this is such a serious situation that it warrants the attention of all American people. This is just a violation of basic civics that every person learns in high school, that the president is charged with executing the laws passed by Congress, that he can't repeal those laws, that he can't change those laws, and he can't immunize his criminal conduct or the criminal conduct of others.
Lisa, you've been with the ACLU for about a year now, and we're just starting a new year. What have you seen in the past year with the ACLU? What are some of the things that really have concerned you the most over the past year, and what do you envision for the year to come?
Well, I've been pleased to join the ACLU this year. I previously had worked as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department under both John Ashcroft and Janet Reno, and so I definitely saw the policy development, legal policy, from two different political perspectives. And what I've seen has been most heartening has been that on the Patriot Act, people from the right and the left and the middle, conservatives, progressives, moderates, have come together to call for reforms to the Patriot Act, which modified the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in several ways, but absolutely did not give the president the power to conduct warrantless wiretapping in foreign intelligence investigations. So that's been something that's been very heartening. Something that's been extremely disappointing this year, and I think the disappointment is shared by many Americans, has been the erosion of the rule of law under this administration, where we have a president and a vice president who believe that they can rewrite any law, that they can usurp the legislative branch in rewriting our laws, that they basically have only the limits they set on themselves, and no limits under the Constitution, under our amendments, or under our federal laws. Coming year, I hope we'll see increased awareness by Americans of the threat this poses to our nation going forward, to the notion that we are, in fact, a constitutional democracy, that no president can dictate our laws, that the laws must be passed by Congress and signed by the president or vetoed by him, not repealed at his will or his whim.
And if listeners want to do something about this, if they're concerned about these developments, what can they do?
Well, one thing they can do is call their members of Congress, call the local district offices, and urge them to urge the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate these crimes. That's a really important step they can take to let Congress know that they're upset about this and they will not stand for this sort of violation of our federal laws, that no one is above the law. This would be an important call for them to make. I think they should talk to their neighbors about it. I know people are busy with paying heating bills and everything else, but in our democracy, these sorts of activities are a threat to the very foundations of American civilization. And so I hope that they'll talk to their friends and neighbors about this and urge them to take action, too, to say that this is not acceptable for the president to say that he's above the law, even in the war on terrorism.
Lisa Graves, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, and I should say, please go to our website at ACLU.org. We've got a number of documents on there, including papers from our litigation that demonstrate how these laws have been violated.
Lisa Graves from the American Civil Liberties Union, good luck. You're doing good work, and it was great to have you as a guest on the program.
Oh, thank you both so much for having me on. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Lisa.
Have a good year, and keep up the struggle.
Thank you so much.
Our next guest is Sabin Willett. Sabin Willett is one of the many lawyers for the Guantanamo detainees. In particular, he's been representing a group of detainees called the Uyghurs, who are from Western China. They're Muslim detainees. They have been found to be innocent of anything, but the U.S. has a problem. The problem is there's nowhere to send them now that they've been found to be innocent. Sabin Willett has also been active on opposing the Graham-Levin Amendment, which is to strip the Guantanamo detainees of any right to go to court and of any right to protect themselves against coerced evidence. Sabin Willett, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Delighted to be here.
Sabin, now you've been representing, I know, a number of the Uyghurs in Guantanamo. Can you just give us a little background to that story?
Yeah, the Uyghurs, Michael, are people from far western China. They're a Muslim minority who briefly had their own republic in the 1940s before it was crushed by Mao Zedong. And ever since, they've been unhappy dissidents in the communist Chinese land area. They live in the part of the world that's always in the crease of the atlas when you open it up. And things have gotten successively worse for the Uyghurs over the course of the 1990s. Many young men fled the area to neighboring countries, including our clients, and a few unfortunates were swept up in the post-Afghanistan invasion by the U.S., and in our case, the clients were sold for bounties by Pakistani bounty hunters to U.S. forces sometime in late 2001.
And how long have they been at Guantanamo?
Since June of 2002, they were, as many of these folks, sent to the U.S. air base at Kandahar, Afghanistan, where they were held in prison from January of 2002 through June, and then they were sent to Guantanamo.
Were there any kind of the sort of heavy measures against these guys, like against other people at Guantanamo, beatings, that kind of stuff?
Well, Kandahar was not a pleasant place, but when I first met my clients, they were at pains to explain to me that they'd had been determined to be innocent, as they put it. And I think the last thing they wanted was some lawyer running around making claims about mistreatment. So as to whatever happened to them in the early days, we're not raising that, let's put it that way.
So they've been there almost 3 years. And what's happened during that period of time to them? What kind of hearings have they had?
Well, 2 days or last week, Michael, they commenced their fifth year of imprisonment by
the
United States in one place or another, Kandahar or Guantanamo. But what's happened is that we think at a very early stage, the government realized it was a mistake. These men were not enemy combatants. So one of the interrogators told one of our clients in Kandahar itself, before they ever went to Guantanamo, at some early stage at Guantanamo, people stopped interrogating them, another indication that there was nobody thought that they were of any value as sources of information. Sometime in late 2004 or early 2005, each of them had a secret tribunal. You're familiar with these so-called CSRTs, which were proceedings held before military officers, theoretically, to determine whether or not the man is an enemy combatant.
How many guys are there? How many people do you represent, Sabin?
We represent 12. We believe there are a total of 23 Uyghurs at Guantanamo.
So go ahead. They went through these CSRTs.
Yes, and the CSRTs determined that, in fact, they're not enemy combatants. But that fact was kept secret from us and, indeed, from the court. We filed cases on their behalf in March, and the government moved to stay, saying, well, you know, we can't be risking national security by disclosing CSRT records, when the government knew that they'd already found them not to be combatants. We didn't find out that they were non-combatants until we got to the base in July of 05.
If they were picked up outside of China, why can't they be returned to the locations from which they were originally kidnapped or apprehended?
Well, that's a good question. They were picked up in Pakistan, and I don't know whether the United States has made efforts to send them back to Pakistan, but they were in Pakistan on a temporary visa, attempting to get a transit visa through Iran to Turkey, where there is a Uyghur community outside of Istanbul. That's where they were headed, looking for work. And it may be that Pakistan is not interested in having them back. I don't know.
And they can't go to China, is that right?
They cannot go to China, where they would just be thrown into another dungeon.
Now, from what I understand, the U.S. claims it's gone to other countries to try and find a place to put them. Is that right?
Yes.
But it hasn't been willing to say they can come into the United States, I presume.
Particularly people who are not in any way, shape, or form threatening to us. That one of the ironies of this is the loyalty of the small expatriate Uyghur community that already exists in the United States and previously has been one of the most favored groups to receive asylum here. Every time we go to a hearing in Washington, all these Uyghurs turn up wanting to know how they can help. I have people calling me saying, literally saying, I have an extra bedroom.
Wow.
So we've been urging the court to parole them into the United States while the government's resettlement effort continues.
Yeah, you had a recent court hearing where I guess the court had some frustration about what was happening to them. Is that right?
Yes, I think it's fair to say a high level of frustration.
So in the meantime, what are their daily lives like? What do they live, you know, what's their life at Guantanamo like?
Well, they live in Camp Iguana, which is where all of the people in this position, that is the non-combatants who, for one reason or another, can't be sent somewhere, are in this small camp called Iguana. Nine men live in a hut together. It's about 20 feet by 10 feet in size. There's another hut that has a television in it, but television doesn't work except to play. I think they have a Harry Potter movie. There's no news, no newspapers, no communication with their families, precious few telephone calls. We've been able to have some lawyer phone calls, but the government listens in. They can't have any telephone communication with their families, for example. It's a very small place. There's a yard they can walk in, which is about the size of, a volleyball court. There's a view out to sea. The government likes to talk about the beautiful view at Camp Iguana. But if you come from Central Asia, a view out to sea just reminds you of how isolated you are, how far from home. That's where they live.
What is your interaction with them like?
My interaction like? Well, we go down to visit them in Camp Iguana, and it's wonderful and it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's another human face to see someone else to talk to for a few hours is a great thing for people who are so isolated. But our relative powerlessness as their lawyers is difficult. I mean, we have to keep coming back explaining that although they've been told they're innocent and although judges have heard their case, nothing is happening. And that's a hard explanation to make in English. When you add Uyghur into it, it gets really hard. Most important thing they can do is write, email, and call their senators and congressmen to urge that habeas corpus not be abolished for people in Guantanamo.
Why don't you talk about that for a second,
sure.
What's going on? I think it's really important.
What's going on now is that in order to get the White House to buy the McCain proscription against torture, which is a good thing, I mean, let's be clear, that's a really good thing. But in order to get the White House to buy off on that, the ugly little deal that's been cut is to eliminate habeas corpus review for people at Guantanamo, which creates a place beyond the law. You know, Donald Rumsfeld's little fiefdom, where there is no law, and where if somebody actually tortures someone, no one's going to know it because they can't bring a habeas corpus petition. But among the many awful things that that result would lead to if the courts ever enforced it is that men that are, even men who are conceded to be innocent, will suddenly lose their right to go to court and ask for relief. And that could be a terrible thing for our clients. Now, while we don't think the courts would enforce it, the fact of the matter is that if the Congress passes that act, the very first thing that we're going to have is more delays in writing of legal briefs and appeals and more time with guys being stuck down in Guantanamo.
Yeah, that's what I see. I mean, I agree with you. I think the problem here is this could just take who knows how long to litigate. It's called the Graham-Levin Amendment, and Sabin is right. It's really just removing a basic statutory and constitutional protection, attempted to move a constitutional protection from our clients. And they may even try and stop you, Sabin, from visiting your clients. Who knows?
Sure. You know, habeas corpus has been around since the barons went and spoke to King John at Runnymede. I mean, it's served a lot of people well over many centuries. It's way older than our own Constitution. And to suddenly throw it out on a December afternoon, you know, in a defense spending bill seems like the height of folly to me. If you have a secret prison on an island, and if the president gets up and says that the people down there are terrorists, then people believe it. I mean, you talk to almost any lawyer who's been to Guantanamo, and the first thing he'll tell you is, my client isn't a terrorist. He's not even alleged to be a terrorist. But if you have this secret place where you can kind of put people and you can deny access to the outside world, it becomes a vent for the public's frustration and fear. You can say, look at us, we're fighting a war on terror. We've got all these bad people down in Guantanamo. And John Q. Public thinks, well, maybe the president's protecting me from bad people. He's got them all locked up down there. And, you know, I don't want to listen to some wild-eyed leftist lawyers complaining about that. They should be locked up down there, too. I think it's all about that.
That's why we got you in the case, Sabin.
Yes, one of the more right-wing of the lawyers.
For those of you just joining us now, we're with Sabin Willett, a partner with the law firm of Bingham McCutcheon in Boston. Author of two novels, he's now representing the Uyghurs in Guantanamo.
Tell us, what got you involved in the first place?
I went to a seminar about that was given by a local panel on international law in Boston, and I was, like everybody else, alarmed by what I was reading in the newspapers about Abu Ghraib. But, you know, I'm a bankruptcy lawyer. I work for banks. I don't know anything about international law and didn't know a thing about the law of war, Geneva Conventions, any of that stuff. So I went to the seminar and listened to an army captain with even shorter hair than mine start to describe how all this stuff was illegal. So it wasn't just awful and immoral. It was actually illegal, which was comforting that it was illegal. And I just decided it was time to get off the sidelines. You got to do something about this. So I got in touch with Michael's folks, and it was at that point that they were figuring out that they had these Uyghurs who were really in a pickle. And so they asked our firm if we would take on a couple of Uyghur cases.
Sabin Willett, who's one of the lawyers for the Uyghurs, an amazing lawyer, actually, has done some wonderful writing, a great piece in the Washington Post about the Graham-Levin habeas stripping amendment, and has written some novels as well. One called The Deal, and the other called The Betrayal. They sound related in some way, Sabin. Thank you, Sabin Willett, for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We recently discovered that the federal government has been secretly monitoring radiation levels at more than 100 Muslim homes, businesses, and mosques in the Washington, D.C. area and five other cities at least. In some instances, without search warrants or court orders, they've put properties under surveillance and have actually gone in to the properties. With us to discuss this development, we have Arsalan Iftikhar of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. Arsalan is the National Legal Director. CARE has recently filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking information about the government's monitoring and other activities. Welcome, Arsalan, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Can you explain to us what is the situation? What did the federal government do here?
Sure. Well, basically, what we have learned from the U.S. News & World Report article from December 22nd, the exclusive, which I'm sure all of us are aware of now, since 9/11, the federal government, particularly the Department of Justice and Department of Energy, have been conducting a radiological monitoring of at least 100 Muslim sites in primarily the Washington, D.C. area, but also in Chicago, Detroit, Las Vegas, and Seattle. The government has still yet to officially acknowledge that this monitoring has occurred, but it seems for all intents and purposes that this is something that is a reality and is something that obviously is quite disconcerting to the American Muslim community, but also should be of concern to all Americans.
Well, so the assumption, I would guess, of these bureaucrats in the government is that Muslim people, because they're Muslims, want to commit an act of mass terror by radioactively infecting hundreds of thousands of people, and they're being vigilant against this. Is that what they're telling us here?
Well, I think, you know, obviously this sends, you know, chilling messages both in the legal circles, but I also think in just public opinion circles as well. I think what this does to the general public who really don't know, you know, on the constitutionality and legal issues involved, I think what it does is it only perpetuates the stereotypes that American Muslims and Arab and South Asians are the others now living in this country, that places of worship, which are considered sort of, you know, holy and sanctified places, could now be potentially making dirty bombs in your area. And I think that sends a very dangerous message to the general American public and really only exacerbates this sort of anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant mentality that we're starting to see after 9/11. Obviously, from the legal aspect of it, you know, we're very concerned because, as the U.S. News article states quite clearly, you know, although a lot of the monitoring was done from public spaces, like, you know, the air on the streets, in numerous occasions the government had to step onto private property.
Well, how'd they decide who they were going to spy on, well, or who they were going to check to see if they were engaged in radioactive activities?
Right. That's actually a very good question, and CARE, our organization, the AAC, the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, both filed FOIAs, Freedom of Information Act requests, requesting not only the policies and memos involved in deciding that this program would take place, but more importantly, a comprehensive list of all the sites that were monitored during this time. Unfortunately, as you guys can probably imagine, we're not getting a lot of information. You know,
well, you just filed, right?
Well, yeah, I'm just saying that, not, you know, obviously in the media as well, the government always seems to rest on the crutch of national security and classified information. And so,
you know what bothers me, Arsalan?
What's that?
If the government creates this kind of fear by dehumanizing people because they're Muslims, it reminds me of what the Nazis did to the Jews. They said they had to put them all in a ghetto because they were disease bearers.
Right.
When you scare people enough and you dehumanize other people, you get the scared people to be willing to do anything, any kind of horrible thing, because you've dehumanized the, quote, enemy. And it seems to me that that's the kind of thing they're playing into here. And Dahlia and I interviewed a physicist a couple weeks ago on our show, a doctor of physics at the Natural Resource Defense Council, Thomas Cochran. He said something really interesting. He said, with reference to this Padilla case, remember the dirty bomber, because evidently the government is looking for dirty bombers in Muslim homes and businesses
and
mosques.
Him with one count of the,
they dropped it. And the reason they dropped it, because it was a totally absurd charge.
Yeah.
Dr. Cochran said that in order to carry enough radiation around that would actually do something, you'd have to have it in a moving van with 3 feet of lead lining. If you tried to put it on your back and carry it around, you'd get melted. And that's the same kind of nuttiness that the government is supposing here when they go into people's homes and businesses and mosques. It's an impossibility. What could these people be thinking?
It's just feeding into the hysteria, Michael. Mainstream media outlets have covered the whole dirty bomb phenomenon and really just reiterated the point that you were bringing up, and that any sort of dirty bomb would be more of a, you know, psychological, you know, would have more of a psychological effect on the populace as opposed to one of casualties. But again, you know, with President Bush and his continued rhetoric of, you know, weapons of mass destruction and terrorists and us versus them and axis of evil and things like that, it's pretty much towing the Bush party line, and we're trying to make sure that we are protected from any potential attacks, whether they be foreign or domestic. But we also do so in a lawful, legal manner that's not going to perpetuate hysteria.
Tell us a little bit about what's legally incorrect about what the government has been doing.
Well, Dahlia, that's actually, we're trying to get more information about exactly what has been going on. The Department of Justice, the FBI, and the Department of Energy's NEST team, the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, basically, have been monitoring up to 120 sites per day, about a year after 9/11, for radiological levels.
Are they still doing this?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, that's one of the things you'll find out. I would imagine they still are. This thing kind of has a life and a logic of its own. Take a page out of Orwell's book, 1984.
Sure.
In order to instill fear, the bad guy was Goldstein. They never caught Goldstein. I don't even know if Goldstein really even existed.
Right.
But they never caught him. They didn't want to catch him because they wanted him out there so you could have something to be fearful of. And then the government could step in as big brother and defend you against this horrible Goldstein out there, just like our government is out there as big brother defending us against these phantom radioactive terrorists.
I mean, it just, to be honest, guys, it literally seems like something out of a Jerry Bruckheimer movie where, you know, not only have we created this concept of the other, but now we have these terrorists who are plotting to, you know, put together a nuclear bomb in a mosque of all places, you know, the most, you know, prototypically Muslim symbol there is, and they found nothing in terms of radiological levels that would be of concern to them.
Yeah, so but that's the point. They don't even have to find anything. All they got to do is say they're looking for it.
Right.
They've been handing out thousands of apparently radiation alarms that people like police officers and firefighters wear like
beepers, right?
And what do? They just walk around during the normal course of their day looking, like walk around a Muslim area or walking around in a Muslim neighborhood or a Muslim neighbor?
Dahlia, from my understanding, that's exactly what it is. It's like a beeper they walk around and basically just, you know, has a little gauge on it. And it monitors.
Wow, that's crazy.
Next
really
step
is.
They're going to do is they'll paint a big red M on Muslims so you can tell who they are in case they're radioactive.
The next step is brand and number us and toss us in internment camps.
Well, let me ask you, can you explain for our listeners, please, what exactly a FOIA is and how you're going to use it to get more information?
Dahlia, every cabinet level department has either a FOIA or a public information officer, and Americans can write in requesting information on policies, procedures, actions that have been taken by that specific department or whatever is within the jurisdiction of that department like that.
The idea, as I understand it, behind FOIAs is that this is supposed to be an open government.
Right.
And unless there are good national security or other reasons why the information should not be public, this is information that is owned by and owed to the American public.
Yeah, but you know what happened. Ashcroft, Attorney General John Ashcroft, said, because the FOIA law was a victory of the radicalization of the 60s. And Ashcroft, when Bush appointed him, came into the Attorney General's office and he said to the rest of the government bureaucracy, somebody like Arcelan makes a FOIA request, turn them down and we'll defend you.
Yeah.
So it's a different ballgame now. You can make these requests, but you don't get the information like you used to.
Well, before Ashcroft, the presumption and the idea of FOIA is the information is entitled to the American public, whether it's an organization or an individual.
Right.
And if it is not to be given, the presumption is always in favor of giving it, and they often give a good reason why they're not going to hand it over if they won't. Now, after Ashcroft, what happened is Ashcroft turned the presumption on its head and said the presumption is now against giving this information. They have to have a really good reason why they need it.
Arcelan, let me ask you this. What can our listeners do to help CARE in its effort to get this information out and to try to quell this hysteria that the government is fermenting against Muslim people?
Well, I think it's important, obviously, for your listeners to just remain, you know, educated and aware of what's going on around them, to become more involved in interfaith, their minority events in their area. And people can start, you know, submitting FOIAs themselves. It's not very difficult to do.
How would they find out how to submit a FOIA?
there is, for the FBI, you can go to their webpage, which is doj.gov. There's always a search engine. You can just type in FOIA, and they usually have a separate page for it. I don't have, obviously, the other ones handy.
I think EPIC, the Electronic Private Privacy Information Center, EPIC.org, I think it is.
We're talking with Arsalan Iftikhar from the National Legal Director of CARE. Do you have a website that people get in touch with you?
We do indeed. It's CARE, CAIR.com.
Okay, Arsalan Iftikhar, the National Legal Director of CARE. Thanks for joining us on
My
Law
pleasure,
and Disorder.
Guys. Thanks.
And keep up the good work.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah,
thanks,
take it easy.
Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.